So when I was thinking about this day, this celebration day, Sangha day, and to write something down, to talk about Sangha, I recalled that I worked as a NHS dentist for nearly 40 years before I started work here, 5.5 years ago or so. And I recall that one day I was going into the surgery and my feet wouldn't go. So I was going into the surgery. Feet wouldn't go with me. They just wouldn't go. And I was kind of getting later and later, and I just stood there thinking, what's happening? My feet won't go. And they just wouldn't. And my body was saying to me, enough, this is enough. What are you doing with your life? What are you doing here? And it was it was a good job. It was a useful job. And I think I was kind of exhausted, but my body was really telling me, stop this and stop. So I did stop, not in the evening, not that morning. I kind of got someone to shove me. Did the book of patients that day and stuff, and then tell the boss, look, I think, you know, time's up here. Really. I started working here 5.5 years ago. What struck me, my feet, I know it's only 5.5 years, but they've always wanted to come here. Mm-hmm. They haven't stopped me coming here. My body hasn't stopped me. And sometimes it's been difficult. I mean, I'm looking around the room, quite a lot of team in the room, they'll recognise that. Sometimes it's difficult to work in a Buddhist centre. But my feet never stopped me arriving. And thinking about this talk yesterday and over the weekend, I thought, is Sangha, really, Sangha that's built this Buddhist centre? It's Sangha that's built all of the Buddhist centres in Sri Ratna. People know, people have physically built these places. Some of you were around 50 years ago when this place, you know, not this place, but three places before this was built. And it seems to me, so what is that? What is that that impels people to say, well, I'll do this. I'll just do this, because they're not doing it for the money, honestly, believe me, they're not. What are people doing this for? And to put into context the Sangha Jewel, we just acknowledged the three jewels, the three precious jewels in Buddhism. For Buddhists, our focus, the precious thing in our lives. So I just wanted to maybe just throw that out there. What's at the centre? What drives us? Are your feet, where are your feet going during the daytime? Do you know what I mean? What are we doing with our lives? And I don't think we often give ourselves time to see that, to do that, to think about that. We just, you know, I did for 45 years, I just went. It was just something I had to do. But I didn't have to do it, actually. So I just wanted to say that before we come on to this little talk. So what I wanted to do was just say, we've got lots of festivals, haven't we, in the Buddhist world? You know, in the Buddhist world, there are lots of festivals. It's like Latin America, I mean, there's festivals all the time. And we have our meeting on a Wednesday, the chair and the mitra convenors, and we meet and we plan festivals, and we've planned festivals for 2026. We've planned 11 festivals for next year. So that's quite a lot of festivals, kind of one a month, really. And of course, the three main festivals are Buddha Day, Sangha Day, Buddha Day, Dharma Day, and Sangha Day. And I wanted in this talk just to mention that the Buddhist calendar is full of festivals, and I'd like to talk about the relationship between those festivals and the three jewels. Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. I'd like to particularly talk about the Sangha Jewel, both in its transcendental aspect and in its pragmatic, practice of Sangha.
There's two aspects, really important aspects, transcendental aspect and the pragmatic aspect of Sangha. So, in the tradition, as Sanishrada said this morning, in the tradition, Sangha Day is the last day of the rainy season retreat. It's the day when what Bante, what Sangharachita calls the full-timers, settle down and the laity look after them for 3 or 4 months in the rainy season. And at the end of that period of time, they're given, the laity traditionally give the monks and nuns new robes and medicines and food and stuff to keep them going for the next 9 or 10 months or 8 or 9 months. And that's not our experience. We don't have a rainy season retreat. We don't necessarily wear robes and we don't necessarily have the laity look after us in that way. This is a traditional way of putting it. But the three main festivals that we do that are of paramount importance to us, I think they occur in a very definite order in the Buddhist calendar. They appear on the full moon nights in May, July and October, generally. And we celebrate Buddha Day, Wesak in Sinhalese. We celebrate Buddha Day when Siddhartha Gautama achieved this profound understanding that we call enlightenment. And Dharma Chakra, Dharma Day, we celebrate his sharing of the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma. We celebrate the day that he presented the Four Noble Truths to his erstwhile five ascetic friends. And then it seems to me that Sangha Day, the first moment of Sangha Day, the first Sangha Day, was the day that those five ascetics understood what the Buddha was talking about. They cottoned on, didn't they? There was a point at which they said, "I know what he's saying." And at that point they said, those five ascetics, one after another, "We'd like to follow you. We want you to be our teacher. Can we follow you?" And in the tradition, the Buddha would say, "Ahimitra," as the Buddha said to Charlie this morning, "Ahimitra, come friend. But you have to go. It's your legs that have to go. It's your feet that have to move. You have to go." And that was the kind of start of that. In my kind of smaller mind, that's the start of those three great festivals in the Buddhist calendar. So Buddha Day and Dharma Day celebrate two discrete occasions in the Buddha's life. But the Sangha Day is a more complex, it's a more complex kind of area, really. It takes a bit more unpacking, Sangha Day. So it doesn't celebrate one discrete event. As I said, it's the end of the rainy season retreat. But these three ideas, we as Buddhists call the three jewels, as we know. And in our practice, they're equal in stature, they're equal in importance, these three jewels. So often, when I first came across it on, people were very hierarchical about the three jewels. Has this happened to other people? They were like, "Well, I'm really into the Buddha. I'm really into his teaching, but I don't really want to talk to anybody. I don't really want to join the Sangha. I'm okay where I am. I'm all right here." And that was me as well, you know. I was like, "Oh, I don't really talk to anybody as well, do I?" We're kind of in a way thrown together. Something happens and we end up in the same place. And we don't often, or we don't necessarily come here or come into any other Buddhist centre with our mates. Is that right?
Yeah.
We generally come on our own. I would say, anyway, I came on my own. It took me a long time to come in through the door. I just thought, do I really want to go in there? You know, what's it going to be like? Am I joining a... Is it a club? Is it a cult? What is it? What's going on? So it took me a long time to come in through the door. But I came through the door anyway, I'm quite pleased to say that I came through the door. Why we come through the door is intensely personal, I think. But it's an enormously important point in our lives, in our spiritual lives. Coming through the door and staying and exploring one's life is an intensely personal thing. And it's all for very different reasons, I guess. When you personalise it, it's for a very personal, different reason. But actually, it's often the same kind of area of stuff. Big things happen in life, loss, tragedy, great joys, great, you know, sort of children get born, people get married as well. Oh, happy stuff happens as well, the sad stuff. But we get in here and it's a place for us to explore the rest of our lives. These, it seems to me, the transcendental kind of rattles us a little bit, kind of pokes us a little bit, and we respond. In some way, we respond to that. So sincere, going for refuge to these three jewels. I'll come on to the Sangha jewel in a minute. I just wanted to talk about the three jewels, really, and going for refuge and what that means. Going for refuge represents, I've written here, a profound shift in our commitment to what Bhante calls an effective Buddhist life. Bhante talks about having an effective Buddhist life. What does that mean, an effective Buddhist life? It's quite a loaded sentence, really. Is my life, is it effective? What am I doing with my life, with this very short life? What am I doing with it? Is it effective? Is it having an impact anywhere besides in my own head? So it's a very important kind of question, I think, this. So the Buddha tells us that the three jewels are the refuges, the safe place, sadhana, a safe place, a refuge from samsara. And I think I've spent many years wandering around samsara looking for a safe place. And there isn't a safe place in samsara. Is that coming as a shock to anybody? I've been looking for a cozy corner in samsara for probably nearly all of my life. Looking for a place where I can sit and bring it on. It's such a slow, tortuous route to start to understand there isn't that place. That place is not here. That place, if we're a Buddhist practitioner, is in the three jewels, is in the refuges. So, Trisarana. Sarana, a refuge, a safe place. So this act of going for refuge, it's not, and it cannot be, an academic or an intellectual exercise. It cannot be a social, there is a social aspect to our lives as Buddhists, but it's not a social or sociological aspect. It's not a hobby, it's not an add-on. It's not an ethnic going for refuge. I was at my... by that, I mean, you know, it's not a... With all due respect to the Church of England, but you know, sometimes you go into a hospital, I was in a hospital recently, they just sort of say C of E. C of E is kind of like a catch-all, isn't it? You know, it's the Church of England. And I was in an ethnic culture, my own family, coming from a Catholic background. My own family, I was at a confirmation. My niece's confirmation day, she was 8, and in Liverpool, and I said to her, there she was, or, you know, the Bride of Christ, there she was, and she's a lovely girl. And I said, oh, are you having a nice day? And she said, I've got £150.
And the point was, of course she was having a nice day. But it's a cultural and ethnic kind of religiosity, if you like. And our going for refuge is not that. It cannot be that. It's dynamic. It's a continuum. It's a verb. We're going for refuge in an ever, ever deeper way. We are going for refuge to the three jewels. It's not a one-off. It's not now it's done. It's deeply profound, incremental understanding of the three jewels. That's how I was thinking about it. It's a deep, an ever deepening understanding of the three jewels. And in the expression of our going for refuge, we do three things. We accept the Buddha as our ideal of spiritual practice, of spiritual, ultimate spiritual enlightenment. We do our best to understand the teaching and the practice. And we look for guidance to those of past and present who are more spiritually advanced than ourselves. So it is a hierarchical kind of situation. There are people who understand the Dharma in a much deeper way than I do. And I really appreciate that. I really love that that's a fact of life, that I can go to people who are more experienced than me and ask them about the Dharma. That's a really beautiful thing, I think. And there's an appreciation in that. There's no resentment in that. It's just an appreciation. It's a flowing appreciation for their understanding. And on a more practical level, I think, you know, I can see some of my chapter here. We meet six, you don't mind me saying, six old men meet every Wednesday afternoon. And we've been meeting for 20 years, you know, and it's great. It's really good. We talk about the Dharma. We talk about the Dharma. We talk about other things. We talk about football sometimes, but we talk about the Dharma. And it's enriching. It's beautiful. It's enriching. And it doesn't start that way. I'm talking, moving on to the Sangha Jewel. It doesn't start that way. It's a bit clumsy and a bit, you know, sort of, you lose your footing sometimes and you don't want to expose yourself or embarrass yourself or, you know, you don't know people when you just join them. But it's worth the pursuit, I think. And I have I'm part of a men's study group on a Thursday night. And it's the highlight of my week. It's absolutely fantastic. It's, you know, again, it's like seven people sitting there looking at the Dharma, pausing. It's a really wonderful group of people. And it's a real privilege to be there in that Sangha, in that sort of, well, I would nearly say like mundane Sangha. It's mundane because none of us are enlightened as far as I know. But it doesn't feel mundane. It feels really rich and deep and profound. So when we go for refuge, often, yeah, as I said, it's a response to a very personal experience. You know, a seeing, an intuition, an insight. It might be, you know, through a loss or grief or bereavement or with appreciation for something. So our study group have been studying this book, Sangharakshita's Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. It's a great book. And it's a commentary on the White Lotus Sutra. And we've been studying it, and I came across a piece that Bhante talks about. Krishna, who's a Hindu demigod. I was thinking, oh, I know this story. I know this rings a bell, this story for me. And years and years ago in India, I acquired this. Well, I didn't steal it, but I didn't buy it either. It was a gift. And I'll just pass it round. And I mean, it's a Hindu artifact.
But the story behind it really resonated with me. And Bhante talks about this story in The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. So I'm just going to pass this round because it's a beautiful piece. And it basically, Krishna, Lord Krishna here with his flute and a cow here with an udder and a flower grows. It's a bit like the Magic Roundabout, actually. Elmendale, was it, or something? Anyway, I'll just pass it round. You can have a little look at it. I'll carry on talking. So the story of Krishna that Bhante talks about in The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment is this story. So, Krishna, one of the great spiritual figures in Hinduism. And he arrives in this particular village in northern India in the middle of the night, and he hides in the forest. He doesn't hide, he's just in the forest with his flute. And the village, that particular village, are cow herders. And the women look after the cows. The gopis, they look after the cows. And they live in mud huts. And the night that Krishna arrives is pitch black and silent, completely silent. Not a star in the sky, no moon, silence. Krishna's in the forest and he begins to play his flute. He plays his flute and the flute, the sound of the flute pierces the blackness. And the women cowherders in the village wake up to the sound of the flute. And they get out of bed and they leave. They leave the house. They leave their husband. They leave their children. They leave the pots and pans. They leave the cows. They leave everything. And they go into the forest to dance with Krishna. And Bhante says that the flute represents the divine, represents the transcendental, and the gopis represent the human heart. So the gopis hear the flute, they immediately follow, they immediately go to the divine, they immediately move into the divine. And I think we all experience that divine music at some point. I think that's what brings us in through the door of a Buddhist center. I don't know if you agree, but that transcendent aspect of life prods us, pokes us, says, listen. Listen, it's like this. It's not the way you think it is. It's like this. And we can follow the music, and we often do, but a really strange thing happens, because no sooner is the music finished than Bhante says, we ignore it. We forget it. We push it away. We explain it away. We rationalize it. We say, it's all here, everything's here. Why am I questioning what's here? What's here is here. Of course it is. It's real. It's relative. But there's an ultimate reality. And that's Krishna's music. That's the transcendental asking us to dance in the forest, if you like. So perhaps we do rationalise, perhaps we do push things away. And perhaps we do ignore the divine at times. I wanted to read a poem by one of the Beat poets, just to keep my street cred, Rob Bukowski. And it's called Bluebird. You may have heard this poem. Don't know. It's quite a hard-hitting poem, so I'll just tell you that. Yeah. But it's about ignoring the divine, ignoring the transcendent. So I just wanted to read it. And normally, sometimes I read this poem in classes, but I only read a bit of it. I just read the very beginning and the very end. I don't read the middle. So today, I'm going to read it all. It's called Bluebird. There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I'm too tough for him. I say, stay in there, I'm not going to let anybody see you. There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I pour whiskey on him and I smoke cigarettes over him. And the whores and the bartenders and the grocery clerks, they never know he's there. There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I'm too tough for him. I say, stay down there. Do you want to mess my life up? Do you want to screw everything up? Screw up the works? Do you want to blow my book sales in Europe? There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I'm too clever. I do let him out at night sometimes, when everybody's asleep. I say, I know you're still there. Don't be sad. And then I put him back, and he's stinging a little bit in there. I haven't quite let him die. And we sleep together like that with our secret pact. And it's nice enough to make a man weep. But I don't weep. Do you? It's a lovely poem. So it's not easy to maintain, Bante says, this faithful commitment to our ideals. But if we push away, we end up unrealised, frustrated. We end up with this very sick bluebird in our heart. But if we allow Krishna's flute, if we dance in the forest, if we deepen our going for refuge, this sarana, two great shifts can happen in our life. The first is we begin to understand that permanence, that deep, deep happiness, that beauty and bliss, even our true identity, cannot be found in the mundane. They can only be found in the transcendental. And the second thing is when we resolve to make this transition from the mundane to the transcendental, the universe starts to work with us, looking for this safety. Perhaps the transcendent offer of safety does poke us from time to time. It does poke us from time to time. So there are aspects in the mundane that lead us on, that bring us on, bring us out, make our feet move toward the transcendent. So I'll talk a little bit about the Sangha jewel. So Sangharacharya again tells us that it's the Sangha that provides the conditions to support our effective Buddhist life, our effective spiritual life. It's the Sangha that provides that support. But I was listening to a talk by Padmavajra, and he was saying you have to be careful how you designate the Sangha, because in a lot of the traditions, the Sangha is simply regarded as the monastic Sangha, and that's the whole Sangha. Particularly in the East sometimes, the monastic Sangha is it. But the other thing that sometimes happens in the West is that that just anybody who loosely identifies with the Buddhist teaching is in the Sangha. And that's not true either. So we have to be careful of these two polarities. and look at what is the Sangha, what is the aspects of the Sangha that are helpful, that are going to help us support our Buddhist life effectively. Of course, traditions, there's the Mahasangha, all of us in this room, the ordained Sangha, the monks and nuns, and the noble or Aryan Sangha, those great beings who have realised their potential, arahats, bodhisattvas. And that's the tradition. But I just wanted to say that Padmavajra again talks about this Aryan Sangha being the starting place. This is the starting place. This is how we define Sangha. It's a practice. Sangha is a profound spiritual ideal and practice that we can contemplate and aspire to. He's talking about the enlightened Sangha here. So yeah, he's talking about the noble or Aryan Sangha, those great beings that provide and inspire guidance. I'm thinking about my own practice of White Tara. It's such a gift. It was such a beautiful gift that somebody gave to me. Somebody talked me through and explained and gave me. And it's just one of the most wonderful gifts I've ever been given, really. So we can invite those great beings into our hearts. We can invite them into our lives. They don't mind. It's all right to invite them, I think. So beautiful as this aspiration may be, the noble Sangha, we have to start somewhere. And I'm a worldling. I can't start with the noble Sangha. I'm glad I came across Tirumatna, because we make a big thing about Kalyana Mitratar in Tirumatna. The tradition of beautiful friendship, noble association. So you all know what Kalyana Mitratar means. This beautiful friendship, this is where we start to form friendships with each other. And as I said before, it can be clumsy, it can be knobbly, it can be, I don't want to be your mate, I don't want to talk to you, but start with the Dharma. Start there. One of my favourite characters in the Pali Canon is Ananda. And for those of you who don't know, Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, he was the Buddha's cousin, and he had this kind of photographic memory. So even when the Buddha gave a discourse, even when Ananda wasn't there, Ananda would ask the Buddha to repeat it all to him so he could remember it. And after the Buddha's Parinirvana, after the Buddha's death, Ananda was the one that went to the Sangha and gave them all of a verbatim account of all the Buddha's discourses. So I love Ananda because he's not enlightened. Mm-hmm. And he's able to ask the questions of the Buddha that I want to ask. He asks the Buddha pertinent questions because he's not coming at it from an arahat's point of view. So anyway, Ananda, he sits with the Buddha one day and says, this is in the Upada Sutta. So, thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying in the land of the Shakyans in a town called Nagarika. Then the Venerable Ananda went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side and said to him, "Sir, good friends, companions and associates are half of the spiritual life." "Say not so, Ananda," the Buddha said. "Say not so, Ananda. Good friends, companions and associates are the whole of the spiritual life. A mendicant with good friends, companions and associates can expect to develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path, the path to liberation." That's what he said. Good friends, associates and companions conduce to liberation. So that's where we start. For me, that's where we start. That's where Sangha is. That's where it starts. The the whole of the spiritual life.
And when we think about the Metta Bhavana practice,
when we think about the neutral person, which people find difficult sometimes, I think they find that the most difficult thing, because there's nothing to get hold of with the neutral person. There's no big dislikes or big likes. There's no history with the neutral person. But if you think about the person you love most dearly in your life now, the possibility is that they were once a neutral person to you. If you hadn't got on that train, they wouldn't be the dear friend that they are today. The neutral person is potential. The rest of the world is potential. And Ananda sees that. And good friends, companions and associates, they do start off as neutral people, generally speaking. We're not born with best mates. You know, we're born with brothers and sisters, I guess, and stuff like that, but you're not born with best mates. It's a progressive practice. Yeah, it doesn't happen by magic. And it can be clumsy. When some thought that I had around this is like we get to know ourselves in relation to others. We really get to know ourselves in relation to others. So I was at a party one time, and this bloke came into the party and he had a cowboy hat on, and it wasn't a fancy dress party. He just had a cowboy hat on, and my mind went, who do you think you are? And your cowboy hat. Who do you think you are in this party with your cowboy hat? It's like my mind was doing somersaults because this man had a cowboy hat. And I kind of examined it a little bit and thought, what are you doing? What is my mind doing? Why have I made a sudden decision about that? Maybe I'm just particularly horrible. But what, you know, we do it, don't we? We react. We react to situations. And what I'm thinking is that they are precious situations. We really see ourselves. We really see our habitual reactions, the way we respond to people. So yeah, it's challenging, but I think if we can be honest, kind, it's a start. And putting stuff down is a really good practice. Putting down the resentment, putting down the hatred, putting down the irritation, putting down the frustration. Just imagine, I'm telling myself this, it's about just put it down. Stop carrying it around. Leave it. Somebody said it's like you wake up in the morning and you shower and you put clean clothes on, and then you remember you've got that really big bag of dead fish under the bed. And then you get it off under the bed and you carry it around with you all the time. Leave it under the bed. So yeah, kindness to ourselves as well. Yeah, put it down, leave it alone. I think then we start to respond to each other as truly human beings, and we become a human being, not just a reactive kind of push button, pull button, painful kind of place to be. So the real practice of Sangha, I suppose, is exemplified in the Anuruddhas, the story of the Anuruddhas, which I'll finish with. So for those of you who don't know, the Anuruddhas, these three guys, they live together. I think they live in a park, or they live in a park, don't they? Yeah. And there's a caretaker in the park, and the Buddha the Buddha's their teacher, and they're terribly developed spiritually, and they're kind to each other, and they enjoy each other's company. And they don't talk to each other a lot. They mostly spend their lives, it seems, in second dhyana. So they don't need to talk to each other an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And they discuss dharma. When they do speak, they speak of dharma. And the Buddha comes to see them one day, and the caretaker won't let him in, and he says, well, you know, I'd like to come in and see these three cats. And the caretaker says, oh, no, they can't be disturbed. They're very, you know, they're advanced spiritual beings. They need to be left alone to do what they're doing for the world. Anyway, they recognise the Buddha and they tell the caretaker to let him in. The Buddha goes in and says, how are you getting on? Well, I'm just paraphrasing here. The Buddha says, how do you get on with each other? He asks them very specific questions. He asks them, are you in harmony? And they answer, yes. How are you in harmony, he says. How are you in harmony? And they describe their practice of loving kindness. How they don't have a rota, you know. They don't have a rota on the fridge. It's your job to do this, it's your job to do that. They just see what needs to be done and they do it for each other. And they anticipate each other's needs. And they live in a heavenly space. They care for each other and they care for themselves as well. It's not that they, you know, it's just as conceited to put yourself at the back of the queue as it is to put yourself at the front of the queue. You know, they care for each other and they care for themselves. They get each other's water, they anticipate for each other. They just do it. They're silent, they explore the Dharma. And then a yaksha, a local spirit, comes and he says to the Buddha, these guys are benefiting the local environment. These guys, with their practice, have a tangible effect on the local environment, on this area here, with their practice of loving kindness towards each other. And not just that, they have an effect, a positive effect, on the world. Their practice has a positive effect on the world. So it's my belief, I'll just finish, it's my belief that, yeah, we can transform ourselves. The Sangha jewel is just as precious as the other two jewels. We can transform ourselves and we can transform the world. And that's me.